Hey, everybody. My name is Barbara Walsh, and I'm an alcoholic. Barbara. Grateful to be here and to be sober. And Maggie and Katie and Susan and whoever else had anything to do with asking me to do this, because I'm just super grateful. Super, super grateful. I love the Roundup. I've gone to everyone except three since I've been sober. And by the way, I should say my sobriety date is March 27th, 1984. My home group is the Ponce Highlands Women's Meeting, although I was raised at Clarkston. And my sponsor is Aloma S. So I was told it's important to have those three things. And if you're new, I would recommend to you that you get those three things: a sobriety date, a home group, and a sponsor. Super grateful to be here. It's wonderful to see y'all. The only reason I've missed any of the Roundup since I've been sober is because I can't get used to it being in August. I'm so used to it being in the middle of July, I keep scheduling conflicts, and so now I've got it on my calendar going out for like the next 10 years so that I won't screw up again. I was in Newfoundland, Canada last year, and I was sick about it. I was absolutely sick about it. And I had a good friend get me the CDs because I was so upset about missing it, but it's just not the same thing. So I'm not going to miss it this year, I promise. The instructions are that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. And the only other instructions that I'm given are on page 29 of this blue book that say each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. And so I hope I'll do that too. I certainly mean to. So what I used to be like. You know, my story is such a great illustration of how this program is an inside job. Because before I got sober, I had a house, a husband, and a job at a university. And now, 35 years after I got sober, I have a house, a husband, and a job at a university. So if you just looked at things, you know, it wouldn't look, you wouldn't be able to see. If you don't look at what it is like, you wouldn't see. But the story, it says I'm supposed to disclose what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And that could not be more different. That could not be more different. When I got here, if I could, sometimes I wish these things were slideshows. If I could show you, what you would see would be this sort of crouched down thing, little, with hair in my face, dark glasses, drapey black clothing, if you saw me at all. But you probably wouldn't, because my primary intention at that point in my life was to be invisible. I didn't want you to see me because I knew if you saw me, you would find me unacceptable and would not want to have anything to do with me. So I just tried to move around the world doing what I needed to do, but not calling attention to myself in any way. And I tried really hard to be invisible. And I just always felt like there was something terribly wrong with me. And then, you know, there was reasons for that. There were people who had told me there were things that were wrong with me. But there was, you know, I never had that voice inside me that said they were wrong. Never. I always believed them. So why? I always have to look at why. Why didn't I have any kind of sense of myself? Or why was I so willing to believe I was worthless and wrong? I think I was okay until I was about 12. I think the only happy memories I have are around 4, but I was through some really intensive therapy. I was able to connect with actually being full of joy and happiness, and that was when I was 4. But you know, and sobriety has been a constant continuing process of getting back to that girl who I was when I was four, sitting in a tree, listening to the birds, picking flowers for my mother, and just wanting to be outside and be in nature. And I'm trying to get there. When I was a kid, we lived in Massachusetts. I was the oldest of six. My mother had those six children in 7 years. So I was the oldest. Remember, I was the oldest. So I got to be an only child for about 11 months. Catholic. I probably don't even need to say that. I had this experience of being on my own a lot. The way my mother talked about it much later in my life, she said it was hard having the second child because you have to set the first one aside. And I was the first one. And I felt very much like I was set aside. But I think I was okay until I was about 12, and we had to move because my father's job got moved. And so I was in this special class for smart kids, and I was always really good in school. I learned to read when I was four. I loved school. I was very, you know, I had a whole lot of sense of I thought I was smart. And I didn't know there was anything wrong with me. I really didn't know there was anything wrong with me. And I thought I was smart. So I had some kind of a sense of being okay from those things. I was in this special class. I was having fun reading Shakespeare and writing poetry and learning French. And then we moved to Cincinnati. And it all went to completely hell. In Massachusetts, there were too many Catholics. There were diversity in my school was, were you an Italian Catholic, a Polish Catholic, an Irish Catholic? Everybody was Catholic. But when we moved to Cincinnati, there were a lot of Protestants. Everybody in Cincinnati is German. Or was that? So there were Lutherans, a lot of Lutherans, and other kinds of Protestants. And as a result, there was actually room in the Catholic schools for us to go, which there hadn't been in Massachusetts. So my parents thought that they should send us to Catholic school. And so I went from this, you know, special classes for smart kids where we're reading Shakespeare to an environment that I can only describe as the Middle Ages with electricity. The nuns still had the all the way down to the floor with the rosary beads that swished back and forth. And they were terrifying, and they would, you know, wrap you on the back of the knuckles. And we had religion for 3 hours a day and science once a week for a half hour. The only thing that was as important as religion was penmanship. And I had a terrible penmanship. And so instead of getting all the highest grades, I got a number of the lowest grades. But that wasn't the worst part. That was bad. You know, it's like I would always been good at school. That was where I got all my, you know, self-esteem from. But that wasn't the worst part. The worst part was I found out that there were things that were terribly wrong with me. I found out that I was fat. I found out that I was ugly. I found out that it was not okay to raise your hand in class when you knew the answer, that they would laugh at you for that. And I was completely ostracized and terrorized for the 2 years that I was at Our Lady of Victory. This is, you know, it's way worse now with social media and all that. You know, they could only terrorize me while I was there. But I didn't have to take it home. Although they would call on the phone and pretend to be interviewing me for things. But that was, you know, that was the least they really couldn't do a lot to me except while I was at school or on the bus. But they would take my lunch away and say, well, that I didn't need it. And, you know, kids, they're wonderful. But I had no idea there was anything wrong with me until this happened. And so it was horrible. It was a horrible, horrible shock. And I was devastated, and I would cry and cry and cry. And my parents And, you know, they would say, well, who cares what they think? There's nothing wrong with you. Who cares what they think? Which is, ironically, the absolute right answer. But I couldn't connect with it. I cared what they thought. I couldn't not care. I didn't know how to not care. I've never been good at not caring. I don't know if y'all are good at not caring, but never something I'm good at. So eventually, my first suicide attempt, I tried to take a whole bottle of aspirin, which left me with problems with my hearing for years. And my parents went, oh, this is a bad thing. We'll let you go to the private school. And I said, no, because I didn't want to have to go through another change because it might be worse. And so this was the first example in my life of staying with something that was killing me when I could have let it go. But no, I was full of fear, and I had never been a fearful child. And I was full of fear. And I was full of fear from then on. Because I knew that at any moment my world could change and not be safe anymore. And so even when I was okay, I was terrified that something would happen to change it. So this experience of total rejection sort of culminated with I won an award for service in the eighth grade and went up to the front of the class to accept my little statuette of the Blessed Virgin. And my eighth grade teacher, Sister Bertha, said to me, oh, and so wonderful, and life of service is a wonderful thing, and you really should consider a vocation, because unattractive girls have a hard time finding husbands. She said this in front of the class. So that was sort of the... And now I realize she was just sharing her own experience. But... you know, that's what we do, right? We share our experience. But at the time, I didn't take it that way. And I would love to tell Sister Bertha, she's gone to the nunnery in the sky, but I would love to tell her I have found three. So somehow I managed. But from that point on, I was not okay. Basically, from that point on, I was just not okay. I was never okay, but I always thought I was going to figure out something to make me okay. So for the next whatever number of years until I got here, I was doing the things that I thought would make me okay, but they never worked. They never worked. And it was always so devastating when they didn't work. And it just one right after another. I graduated third in my class in high school. We had 476 kids in the class. I graduated third, and I was devastated. I felt like a complete failure because the first two kids got to sit on the stage and make a speech, and I'm down in the class, down in the on the football field with the other 474 kids. So I might as well have been last. I went to a college where everybody was a little bit different. Oberlin College, I don't know if anybody's heard of it. But back in the 60s, it was a kind of a cool, hippie place. And that's where I became a daily drinker. And I didn't even notice it. And I should have noticed it because it was a dry town. So I had to go to some difficulty to get whatever it was I wanted to drink. I don't really even know today how I managed to drink every day, but I did. And I just had this inability to connect with other people. I made friends my freshman year because they were making friends. But I never connected with anybody after my freshman year. The only people I'm still in touch with from college are my freshman year roommate and another friend from down the hall. I didn't know how to connect with people because I was so fearful that I would be rejected that I just shut down and I just never expressed myself in any way. I almost missed my commencement. My parents, I'm the oldest, right? I'm the first one to graduate from college. My parents drove up from Cincinnati. We're going to have this wonderful commencement. I was laid out drunk on the floor of my room because I had had somebody had thrown a party for me the night before. I worked at this restaurant, and the place where I worked had thrown a party for me, and they had punch with grain alcohol in it. Oh. It was sort of a grape punch with grain alcohol in it, and I was incapacitated. I was so incapacitated, I almost missed my own graduation. So drinking was already, as you can see, a little bit of a problem for me. And then over the next 10 years, I was loose in the universe. I graduated from college. I was loose in the universe, and I was trying to build a life for myself, but I kept having to give things up in order to continue to drink. So in 1974, I was living in Atlanta by then. I moved to Atlanta because I had to get out of the house. My parents were like not happy that I didn't have a career. I was supposed to be a teacher. I was supposed to be a French teacher. So I moved to Atlanta and sent off for the applications to teach. I was living in Cobb County, so I got Cobb County, and I got City of Atlanta and one other place. I don't remember what the other applications. Three applications to teach. And lo and behold, on the applications, it asked two questions. It said, do you drink alcohol? Do you smoke? And since I did both, I knew they didn't want me. So I threw the applications in the trash and became a cocktail waitress because, you know, they didn't mind if I drank and smoked. They didn't mind at all, even though I had felt called my whole life up to that point to teach. And I had suffered through those ridiculous education classes. And I had done my student teaching for 2 years because I wanted to be able to teach in elementary school and in high school because I was a French teacher. It was just that easy. Well, if they, you know, they don't want you if you drink, so they don't want me. And I gave it up, and I never did teach. So that was the first one. Now, a lot of people have to have their driver's licenses taken away from them because of their drinking. A lot of people lose their license to drive. But not me. I never lost my license. Back in 1978, I was running a rock and roll nightclub in underground Atlanta, and I had a little empire down there. I had two rock and roll nightclubs, a sandwich shop, and a pizza place, Jocko's Pizza. This is underground Atlanta in the 1970s, back when it was cool, and a little bit of edge to it. Anyway, I was down there running these places, and the band loaded out on Saturday nights, right? So they were there loading out, and I was there with them until really late. And, of course, I was drinking. And, you know, I always tried to put off the first drink. But on Saturdays, you know, I would start drinking a little bit earlier down at Mule and Brink's. I'd have a few drinks at Mule and Brink's, and then I'd come back to my place and open up. And anyway, by the time the band got through loading out, it was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I've been drinking it since about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, pretty much nonstop. And I lived not very far from, I'd had a number of interesting incidents with driving home from work. One time when I was working at Kelly's on Peachtree, I lived like a mile from there. But when I got up the next morning, all four of my tires were flat because I had bounced off the curbs on both sides of the street on the way home and bent all four rims. So I couldn't live very far from where I worked. So I was living at Peachtree North, and I made it all the way home. And I made it up the first ramp, and I made it up the second ramp, and on the third ramp in the parking garage, I went to sleep or something. I don't know. And I stuck my car to the wall, and I dropped a cigarette on myself, and I was wearing one of those satin acetate. You know, Saturday night, you got to be flashy. So I set fire to myself, and I couldn't get the car off the wall, and I had to go upstairs and get my soon-to-be husband, who was just thrilled. to come down and get the car off the wall. And at this point, it was clear to me I could no longer drink and drive. So I gave away my car. And I didn't drive for the last 6 years that I drank. I did not drive. I rode MARTA. I feel so bad for anybody that has to do that. I got rides from people. I took the bus to the train to the bus to the train to the bus to the train to the bus to the... I mean, it was... But I would not drive because I knew that I couldn't get away with it. I knew I couldn't get away with it. So that was the second thing. And then in 1979, I started having problems with my birth control pills. I was having some high blood pressure. I'd been on them for a long time, and high blood pressure, you know, I thought it was from the birth control pills. High blood pressure. So, and you know, I had this nervous condition, especially in the mornings. I never took a morning drink because I didn't know it would help. I didn't come from an alcoholic family. I know that my alcoholism is not my parents' fault because I have four perfect sisters. Absolutely perfect sisters who had the same parents. And my parents are not alcoholic. My mother's father was alcoholic and he abandoned them when she was four. So I never even saw him. I never knew him. I never heard anything about him. She didn't remember anything about him. So the alcoholism in my family was something I was totally unfamiliar with. I had never seen alcoholism. I didn't know what it was. But I had this nervous condition. And I didn't know it was from drinking. I just thought it was something wrong with me because I have so many things wrong with me, remember? And there's this noise that kids make when they're happy, you know, like at a swimming pool or, you know, when they're playing and they're really, really happy. It's like a screech. I couldn't stand it. It's fingernails on a blackboard. I couldn't stand it. So I knew I was never going to have children. I just knew I would never be able to. Other people could, but, you know, there was something wrong with me. And I was just never going to be able to have children. You know, most women have to have their kids taken away from them in alcoholism. I just had my tubes tied. Because, you know, I had to drink. And so, I was not willing to let anything stand in the way of continuing to drink, and the reason was it was my medicine. I had tried all these things to fix myself, and I still had this at the core, this self-loathing. I couldn't put my makeup on in a full-size mirror. I had to use this little hand mirror to get ready for work because I couldn't stand to look at myself in the mirror. And I tried everything. I tried husbands. I had two of them before I got here. I went back to school and got another degree. I passed the CPA exam, which was the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life up to that point. I thought I was smart until I took that exam. And then that was just so difficult. And it didn't fix me either. About 3 days after after they sent you the news that you passed, they have the ceremony, or they used to. I don't know if they still do. And there's this dinner, and they give you the certificates. The greatest achievement of my life to date. And I thought, well, surely this is going to fix me. And I go up there, and I get my certificate, and I sit down at the table, and I felt exactly the same. I still felt like I was completely worthless and ugly and unacceptable. And I went out in the sort of the foyer of this hotel ballroom and just sobbed because it didn't work. And I couldn't think of anything else to do because I had already changed jobs and changed husbands and got another degree. And I'd done everything I could think of to do. In 1980, I thought, well, if I didn't drink for a living, maybe, you know, it wouldn't be so out of control. So I got a straight job. I went to work at Georgia Tech after, 15 years in the restaurant and nightclub business. I had gone back to school, so I was able to talk my way into this accounting job. And I thought that was going to work because, I wasn't going to be drinking at work anymore. But, it probably kept me drinking longer because it helped me put off the first drink. But I drank every day. There were two things that I knew for a fact. I knew I had to drink every day, and I knew that once I started for that day, I wasn't going to be able to stop. So I just put off starting. And as long as I could put off starting, I wasn't really powerless. It got to the point where I couldn't put off starting anymore. But I just tried everything I could think of to try, and nothing worked. And so when I passed the CPA exam, I got my CPA certificate, and that didn't work. I just gave up. And I started drinking like I wanted to all along. I didn't immediately start drinking at work, but I started drinking liquor, which I'd never done. I'd always been a beer drinker, a light beer drinker, because, try to not get in trouble too much too quick. And I started drinking gin. I started drinking cognac. I started drinking the minute I got home from work every day, and I was getting home at 5 o'clock every day because I wasn't going to school anymore. Up until that point, I'd been going to night school for like 5 years. So I come home from work, mix a martini, start drinking, pass out on the floor. I had a husband at this time. I had my second husband at this time, and he thought I should do something about my drinking. Nobody else knew except family, and I only saw them at Christmas, but because they were all elsewhere. But he knew, and he was a recording engineer and a guitar player. But he was a recording engineer, so he thought he'd be real slick. He recorded me when I was drunk. I would always go on these rants. I was never angry when I was sober, but when I got drunk, I'd get angry and start screaming at him for not making any money, which he never did. And I'll just point out. And I just, I'd go off. All this rage would just come flying out of me when I was in a blackout. I had to be in a blackout for this to happen. And he thought if he recorded that and played it for me, that I would see the light and stop drinking. But he never could get me to listen to it. I would not listen to it. I was not going to listen to it. I didn't want to know what happened when I was in a blackout. He always thought I wanted to know. I never wanted to know. So he had a friend. He was a guitar player. He was in a band. And the bass player in his band was a guy named Harry O. Some of you may know Harry. I knew Harry when he had 2 years, and I was still drinking. And my husband would say, "You need to go to AA." Harry goes to AA. Harry loves AA. And I'd say, "Great, I'm so glad for Harry. I'm really happy for him. But I'm not the least bit interested because I couldn't even imagine not being able to drink. I knew you people didn't drink. So I wasn't coming." Period. End of story. The only thing that made it possible for me to live in the universe was that I knew I could drink. And I was getting to the point where I was having to drink at work. I would go out and drink at lunchtime, which was socially acceptable. And I was carrying around a pint of grain alcohol in my briefcase, just in case I needed to put a little something in my coffee. I hadn't started drinking it yet, but it was there. And I'd go out for lunch to Clarence Foster's and have a martini and a bowl of soup and a glass of wine and come back to work and close the door and sleep on the floor for a little while. It was sooner or later I was going to get in trouble. I had not gotten in trouble. They had no idea, but I could see it coming. I was like, the cliff is right there. I would go in on Sunday with a six-pack of beer and catch up on the work that I didn't get done during the week as I was laying on the floor. Sooner or later, they were going to figure it out. This was not okay. But I didn't see that there was anything I could do to stop it. And I was terrified. But I couldn't not drink, because then the black hole of self-loathing and terror and despair would just consume me. So I'd kill myself. So I had 27 suicide attempts when I got to the program, and most of them were pretty half-assed. They were like, we're going down the street 65 miles an hour and I try to jump out of the car. Things like that. They weren't well thought out, let's just say. They weren't well thought out. I got really mad at my husband one time and tried to run off the top of a six-story parking garage. I woke up the next morning and I had all these scrapes all over me on my face and my arms, and I was like, what the hell happened? This is one time I did ask what happened. And he said, you tried to run off the top of the parking garage and I tackled you. So that was, you know, it was those kind of suicide attempts. They were like flash suicide attempts. I'm going to kill myself now. And somebody always saved me, and I'm so grateful to the people who kept me alive long enough to get here, because I didn't do it. I didn't want to be here. I was lost. I was trying so hard, and nothing worked. Drinking only made me feel better for like the first two drinks. And then I would start spiraling into even worse depression. And then I was in a blackout. And then I was in a rage. And then things happened. And my husband quit coming home when I was there. And it was just, it was so lonely. And I had nobody to talk to. So what happened? Here I am, 1984. January or February of 1984, I went to a convention in New Orleans. And they let you drink 24 hours a day. I couldn't believe it. And they had bars on the convention floor. And I was just out of control. I started drinking for breakfast. I drank all through the day. I was in a blackout by the time we went to dinner. I was with another colleague, so it's the only reason why I didn't get killed or worse. But when I got back from that conference, I was physically sick from drinking for the first time that I was aware of. I mean, I was literally physically sick from drinking for probably a couple of weeks. Of course, I continued to drink, but I was that was... It made me even more afraid, because it's like, I'm going to be drinking like that all the time pretty soon, and I'm going to be sick like that all the time pretty soon. And I didn't have the vaguest idea what to do about it. So I bought a computer. This was in 1984. There weren't very many computers. Long story short, they gave me one for my house. They didn't give me one. They sold me one for my house. And this young fella came over to help me with my computer. Now, he was a Christian. A real Christian. He was helping me with my computer, and we kind of got to be friends. Now, he was really young. This was not a romantic relationship. He was like my son, if I'd had one. He was that old. But he realized how much trouble I was in on the inside. I still looked okay on the outside. But he realized how much trouble I was in on the inside. And he started to see some of the behavior and the suicide attempts. He didn't see any of the actual suicide attempts, but he saw some of the aftermath. And he told me that he would not be my friend unless I went to see his therapist. Now, I had not had a friend for 20 years or something. I don't know how long. So I was furious with him that he would blackmail me like this. But I couldn't just say, well, screw you, I'm not going, because he was a friend, and he really did care about me. Not that I thought his therapist was going to be able to help in any way, but so I went because Rob said I had to go. And his therapist didn't help at all at first. He gave me medication, and I drank on top of the medication, and things got really crazy. I started having blackouts during the day when I was sober. And I would be sitting in my office, and my mind would travel up to the upper corner of the room and look down on me and talk to me. This is what happens when you drink on top of antipsychotics. But eventually he figured out what he had on his hands, and he told me we were going to go to the hospital. And I thought, okay, I figured DeKalb General, I got to find a drink and alcohol in my briefcase. We'll be fine. But he didn't mean that kind of hospital. So on March 27th of 1984, he walked me into the Psychiatric Institute of Atlanta, where they locked the door behind me, took away my briefcase, and went to check my insurance. Because I was working at Georgia Tech, I had excellent insurance. Wasn't it wonderful? So they thought I should perhaps stay for a while. And he was locking me up for suicide. He wasn't locking me up for alcoholism. He was locking me up for suicide, and he said, I can keep you here for 48 hours, whether you like it or not, but I suggest that you stay. So here I am. I was in a suit because I was on my way to work when I went to see him that day. And so none of the other patients would talk to me because they thought I was staff. So here I am, locked up in the Psychiatric Institute. And nobody would talk to me. And I didn't know what to do with myself. And I didn't know why I was there or what I was going to do. But it began to evolve that they thought that I should go to these substance abuse meetings. So I think it was my second or third day that I was locked up at PIA. The charge nurse told me I had to go to this AA meeting. And I wasn't going to go. I wasn't locked up for drinking. I was locked up for suicide, and so I said I wasn't going. And she said, no, you have to go. And I was like, I'm not going. So here I am, and you know, defiance being the outstanding characteristic. And I wasn't interested in quitting drinking, remember? That's not why I was there, and I wasn't interested. So I wasn't going. And one of the other alcoholics, if you're ever locked up on the nut ward, the only good information that you get when you're locked up on the nut ward is from the other nuts. And so this guy who became a dear friend, Gene, came over to me and said, no, you want to go to the AA meeting. I said, why do I want to go to the AA meeting? He said, it's the only place in the hospital where they have real coffee. All the rest of the coffee anywhere in the hospital was decaf because they don't want the nuts getting all juiced up on caffeine. But they let the alcoholics who come in to do a meeting have real coffee. So everybody runs off to the meeting to have coffee. So I went to my first AA meeting for the approval of the charge nurse and for coffee. And so there was the Juniper group of Alcoholics Anonymous who came into the psychiatric hospital and was willing to meet behind locked doors in a locked ward to show people like me what Alcoholics Anonymous looked like and felt like. And I'm so grateful to them, so grateful for the rest of my life. The Juniper group still exists. It's no longer being held captive in a psychiatric hospital. It now meets in a church down on Juniper Street. But that group was a real AA meeting. And they met inside that locked facility. And so I went in on a Wednesday night, and I sat in those orange molded plastic chairs, which I can still see. And I sat on the back row where, you know, newcomers are supposed to sit. And I had absolutely no interest in anything. I wasn't there to get sober or I wasn't interested in you people. I was just putting in my time until I could get back to my therapy group where I could talk about my feelings and learn why I was committing suicide. And they had me on detox meds, but I wasn't taking anything else because they didn't think I was really crazy. They just thought I was a drunk. But I didn't know that. So I sat there and I listened to y'all. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. Here was this room full of people that could not have looked more different from one another. There was this old white guy in a wheelchair who was a vet. There was this middle-aged woman in a mink coat who was from Buckhead, one of the big Buckhead families. There was a guy with no teeth who had just got out of St. Jude's, who just happened to live in the neighborhood. Talk about a group of people who would normally not mix. It was in the extreme. It was such a diverse group. And for some reason, I started hearing what you were saying. And I heard one guy say that he had just got out of the hospital and he was going to have to go back to work. And he was terrified. See, he didn't know if he could work without drinking. He was a roofer. And all the roofers drank. I didn't know all roofers drank. That's kind of scary. Roofers? Seems like it would be kind of a hazardous thing to do, but he said they did. He said all roofers drank, and he was going to have to go back to work, and he didn't know what he was going to do, and he was terrified. And I had never heard a man say he was afraid before. And then this guy named Joe L. from the Galano group said that he had been sober for 30 days and he was starting to have flashes of self-esteem. Flashes of self-esteem. And I thought, is that what this is for? I didn't know that was what this is for. I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was just a bunch of people who got together and held on each other for dear life so that they wouldn't drink even though they really, really wanted to. I thought I knew everything. I had no idea that this was about all the things that were really wrong with me. I knew that the drinking wasn't the problem. I knew the drinking was my medicine. And, of course, it had side effects, but all medicine has side effects. I mean, look at chemotherapy, for Christ's sake. You're going to have side effects. But I really thought of it as my medicine. I needed it. Because I was so broken, and I couldn't live with what was going on inside my own head. And I had no idea that there was a name for that, and the name for that was alcoholism. I had no idea until these people started talking about their alcoholism. And I was just absolutely blown away. I went back to my little cell, and I wrote down what that guy had said about flashes of self-esteem. And I talked to my friend Jean. And I started thinking, you know, maybe what I want to do is hang out with these people. I think I'd like to do that. And if I have to stop drinking to do that, maybe I'll try. Because I think that the way that these people loved each other, it was like a family reunion. It was a locked door. So Bernard would go over and unlock the door and somebody would come in and everybody would run over and throw their arms around. And then the door would lock and then somebody else would come up to the locked door and it'd start all over again with all the hugs and kisses and family reunion. I'd never seen anything like this before. I come from a non-demonstrative family. And I had never seen grown-ups act like that before. And I could tell that it wasn't fake. I could tell that y'all actually loved each other and cared about each other. I could feel it, even with detox meds. I could feel it. And I now know that what I was feeling was my higher power that was in that room because you brought him there. each one of you a little piece. And when there are enough of you there, it gets so big I could feel it even on detox meds. And I just wanted to be with you more than anything in the world. And if you said I had to stop drinking to do that, well, then I thought I would just have to stop drinking. And I had no idea that I could go out and come back and go out and come back and go out and come back and y'all would still love me. I didn't know that. I'm glad I didn't know that. Because I've been sober ever since my first meeting. Because I just wanted to be with you people. I was from the very first entranced with the fellowship. Now, I didn't do everything right. I went to meetings. I did that much. The most important meeting I think I ever went to was the night after they let me out of the hospital. I went and bought a car. The day they let me out of the hospital, I went and got my driver's license back. They didn't take it from me. I lost it because it had expired. So I went to the little place behind the shopping center on Memorial Drive and got a driver's license. And I bought a car because I didn't have a car. And I drove back down to the hospital to go to an AA meeting. And I came through that locked door. And they came over and threw their arms around me. And I just thought, I did it. This is it. I just want to do this for the rest of my life. And so then they started telling me what to do. You know how they like to do that. You know, once they got you. So, you know, they made me do a lot of things that I didn't think made any sense. But you all know all about that. They made me get a sponsor. They made me get a woman sponsor. I didn't want a woman sponsor because I didn't like women. And the reason I didn't like women is because they didn't like me. My experience with women was that in order for them to like you, you had to be little and cute and, you know, and curl your hair and put on makeup and all this kind of stuff. And I wasn't pretty enough. I wasn't pretty enough to have a girl sponsor. I knew that that I was going to be rejected by any woman that I asked. But they made me get a girl sponsor. So I got this woman who was the least feminine woman I could find. She was a very, very butch lesbian. She wore a chain belt and had whips on her wall at home. And I don't know if any of y'all knew Denny G, but she was perfect for me. She was fantastic. And she taught me one of the things that I still use today, every day, which is that I can't bring anything back from the future but fear. The only thing I can bring back from the future is fear. And I use that all the time. She taught me that. She taught me a lot of things. And then she disappeared. She just disappeared. Back in those days, you could do that. There was no cell phones or social media. She just disappeared. I don't know. Something was going on in her life. She didn't want to have all these sponsorees anymore. She just disappeared. So I had to get another sponsor. And I had to leave that group where they loved me and go to a home group in my neighborhood because they made me. So I went to Clarkston. They said, go to Clarkston. It's good for women. There's a lot of women there, sober women. There were always this thing about women, 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 women. Oh. And I didn't want to have anything to do with women, as I mentioned previously. So I got another sponsor, and the first thing she said was, you have to go to the women's meeting. You have to go for a year, and then if you want to stop, you can stop. And it was absolutely the perfect thing for me, because by going to that women's meeting, I learned what it means to be a woman, sober woman, what it means to be real, what it means to be connected with your heart, what it means to struggle with all the things that I had always struggled with. I had no idea that women in the program... There was this little girl that came into Clarkston named Kathy, and she had little curly blonde hair, and she was thin, and she was a drummer, and and she could not get sober. And I thought, I told her one time, I said, I always thought if I looked like you, I wouldn't have to drink. I was sure that that was what was wrong with me, was what I looked like. And I found out that other women struggle with the same feelings of not looking good enough, not being good enough, not ever being enough, and feeling like they wouldn't be accepted by other women because other women are cooler and thinner and, you know, have better hair. So, you know, and we all just really want the same thing. We all just really want to connect. And I learned how to do that at that Clarkson women's meeting. I learned how to connect with other women. And my home group now is a women's meeting. I wouldn't take anything for the women in my life. They showed me what it means to be real and transparent and authentic. And they taught me that it's always safe to tell the truth about how I feel. So, and it's probably time for me to wind this thing up. But a couple other things that I learned that are really important to me that I try to remember all the time. The first 3 years that I was here, I was an approval junkie. I just wanted your approval. I would do anything. You want me on a committee? Sure. You want me to do this? Sure. I'll do anything. Just give me the pats on the back. I was staying sober on the fellowship. I was trying to work the steps, but I was staying sober on the fellowship, and I needed your approval. And then I went through this process of working the steps again with a new sponsor, and it was a really transformational process. And one of the things that I learned in doing it was that all the time that I was looking for approval, I thought that was love. And love and approval are not the same thing. That in point of fact, when my parents were giving me all that disapproval, my parents were very hypercritical of me, the oldest, I wasn't doing anything right. When my parents were giving me all that disapproval, it was because they loved me and they were full of fear. It wasn't because they didn't love me. And when I learned that, then I was all of a sudden able to feel the love for my parents for the first time in my life. And I established a relationship with them as an adult and had a wonderful, wonderful, large number of years in a close relationship with my parents who I had run away from when I got out of college because I knew that they disapproved of me and I couldn't stand to be around them. And I lost both my parents in 2012. They died together from carbon monoxide poisoning. And boy, that was something, you know, with all my fears of the future, I never imagined that one. Never. So it just goes to show you that all these, you know, practicing up for the future that I do does me no good because I can't imagine the things that will actually happen. And because of the power of my relationship with my higher power that I had found through doing the stupid things that my sponsor made me do, I was able to get through that with the love of God and with the love of you people. My first sponsor made me pray when I didn't believe in God, and I told her that I thought that was a violation of the principle behind the first step, which is honesty. And she said what she always said: who cares what you think? Just do what I do. And eventually I had to worry about my thinking. I had to do a lot of work on my thinking. But in the beginning, it was about doing what they told me to do. If I'm here for any reason, it's because I did what they told me to do. Another thing that I learned that was absolutely critical was that I had it exactly backwards, that I thought that I had to get something from other people. I had to get love from you. I had to get approval from you. I had to get something from you. When in reality, that never worked. I couldn't feel it. And the reason I couldn't feel it is because the door was closed on the inside. I had to open that door from the inside, and the way that I did that was I needed to give something, not get something. I had to love you, whether you loved me or not. And then I could feel it. that I could feel it when people loved me. I'd never been able to feel it before. So it was just all about plugging into that same feeling that was at my first AA meeting, that love, that Holy Spirit, that power of God for love and for good. And it just, you know, I can plug into that power at any time, and it carries me through whatever's going on in my life. And a lot of things have happened. I've been sober for 35 years. I've been sober for more than twice as long as I drank. So a lot of things have happened. I have a new husband now. I've had a couple of jobs. I got forced out of a job that I never wanted to quit. And I went to meetings and cried. And I had people tell me that I had too much time to be crying in meetings. And I went to meetings and cried anyway. And I got through it. It was a grief process, and I got through it. I found a wonderful husband in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been married for 30 years. I'm his third. He's my third. People ask me, what was wrong with your first two husbands? Absolutely nothing. The one thing they had in common was me. They were nice guys. They were just... I wasn't capable of forming a true partnership. I wasn't capable. And I had to blame them. So many things that I've been through in 35 years, but the one thing that's a constant is I go to meetings. I talk to my sponsor. I sponsor people. I sponsor a lot of people, and I love doing that. And I just love the fellowship. I have loved the fellowship from the very first day. So if I can remember what my first sponsor told me about the only thing I can bring back from the future is fear, and stay in the moment, stay right now, because God is right now. If I'm not in right now, then I am not connected with God. God is right now, and right now is okay. I'm safe. And I'm connected with you people and with God. So at the beginning of every meeting, during the moment of silent meditation, I always say this little prayer. God, thank you for bringing me to this meeting and help me hear what I need to hear and say what I need to say. And I'll just close by saying what I need to say, which is thank you for my life. Thank you.